Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote hearing of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Witun.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson. Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Haley. Representative Kegel.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Don't need to really pay attention. And,
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Lucera.
Lucera present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Farr present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson. Representative Tice.
Tice present.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson's present.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney present.
Representative Haley.
Haley present.
Representative Lee. And Representative Richardson.
Present.
We have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from March 16th, 2022. Vice Chair Cotiza Witun, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes.
Vice Chair Cotiza Witun moves the minutes from March 16th, 2022. Any discussion to that motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 16th, 2022 are approved. Our first bill on our agenda today is House File 4008. Welcome to the committee, Representative Bonner. I will move House File 4008 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Bonner, I understand you have an amendment.
I do. I have the A5 amendment. If you would care to move that on my behalf.
I would be very happy to move the A5 amendment. Could you briefly describe what the A5 amendment does?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll just kind of briefly cover the highlights of the amendment for you. First, it removes or eliminates the network adequacy provisions. This is an agreement with our stakeholders and represents compromise in the valley to allay any potential concerns. It also adds the health insurers in Minnesota are to be covered through their medical benefit or pharmacy services for patients, like any other provider is covered under Minnesota Statute Chapter 62. It adds the clean claims language that was a bill by Representative Schultz last year, or references that I should say, which specifically makes sure that a payer may not have their payment delayed or refused for a clean claim, and sets the standard around payment as some credentialed organizations have sometimes been denied payment or payments have not been treated consistently. It adds clarifying language to make clear that it is not an expansion of the scope by adding additional language on lines 1.4 that mirrors the language in subdivision 13K on lines 3.20 and 3.21 for consistency throughout the bill, and adds the reference to the statute in sections 161, which also clearly defines the pharmacist's scope of practice to ensure that the intent is crisp and consistent. It also revises some effective dates to the date of June 30th of 2023. Overall, the amendment before you today represents a copious amount of work and working with stakeholders to find compromise. We have worked in recent weeks with DHS, the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and payers, including Medica and the Minnesota Council Health Plans, to arrive at a consensus to cover Minnesota pharmacy health services in Minnesota. And I respectfully ask for your support of the A5 amendment.
Members, any questions or discussion to the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A5 amendment is adopted. Representative Bonner, I don't know if you have, do you have additional remarks to make about the bill before we go to testifiers?
I do.
Okay, Representative Bonner.
I do have a presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you today is pretty simple and straightforward. It ensures that fully credentialed trained pharmacists and supervised pharmacy technicians who are an essential part of the continuum of care may get paid for the services they perform for patients in the pharmacy setting. These services include specifically the administration of basic maintenance medications such as Vivitrol for the treatment of alcohol or opioid use disorder, or they provide essential services like vaccinations, health testing, and other medication management services for patients. Starting last year, we authorized pharmacists to prescribe, counsel, and administer health screenings and work with patients attempting to quit smoking and made it easier for women to obtain contraception. All of these worthy services take time, effort, and expertise to deliver, make it essential that we pay pharmacies for the care and time they devote to the services they provide. A trusted pharmacist is often the most essential piece, or one essential piece, of the care team for patients that consists of dedicated professionals, starting with doctors, nurses, and clinicians. By having pharmacists and pharmacies as partners in patient care and treatment, we provide patients across the state with the convenience they want and the access they truly need for their care. With more with Minnesotans living within 5 miles of a pharmacy, this bill also is about access for those rural and urban areas, for our elders and those individuals with transportation or for without transportation for whom the healthcare desert could be a reality should they lose their local pharmacy. Our local pharmacies form the cornerstone of our communities, with many patients seeing their pharmacists more frequently than their healthcare provider, forming a significant level of trust. Ultimately, providing these services in the pharmacy as part of the continuum of care means lower costs for patients and payers, and most importantly, we ensure better patient care and outcomes for patients in both rural and urban settings across the state. As fully credentialed pharmacists and pharmacy technicians provide the essential access to services patients need in a setting they know and trust, it makes sense that they should get paid for the services they provide to meet the needs of our communities. Lastly, this bill ensures that local and independent pharmacies in greater Minnesota and our urban centers can continue to provide these services, ensuring their survival and their ability to thrive in our communities. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I do have some testifiers here today, and I will turn it over to them.
Wonderful, thank you. We do have three testifiers, the first of which is Jason Miller. Mr. Miller.
Good afternoon. Well, Representative Bonner, I think you pretty much said it all for me. Great job, thank you, appreciate it. And so my name is Jason Miller. I am speaking in support of this legislation as clinical program manager for Coburn's and Cashwise Pharmacies, as well as the co-chair for the Public Affairs Committee for Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I want to thank you and your colleagues that recently passed legislation to allow pharmacists to provide care. We appreciate you advocating for us. It means a lot. And I do want to mention that we did pilot some of those new services. So we did a birth control service for patients in two locations this past year. And the program was very much appreciated by our patients. It gave them convenient access to medical care in our rural communities. Unfortunately, when we tried to bill for these encounters, they reject as not covered for provider type, meaning that this service would likely be covered by a physician or other provider, but not when billed as a pharmacist. Additionally, we have been providing tobacco cessation services in our clinic setting for a number of years via collaborative practice agreement. And due to that same rejection, we don't even bother trying to bill for it anymore. Instead, we get reimbursed for that by the clinic. So. Unfortunately, many of my pharmacy colleagues throughout the state have had to close their doors, including in rural and traditionally underserved areas, as Representative Bonner mentioned. And so payment for services is essential to keeping pharmacies open and access to care for patients. So again, thank you for the trust in our profession and our ability to provide care for our patients. And we hope now that we can follow through with ensuring that providers are reimbursed fairly for the time, expertise, care, and administration of those services. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Our next testifier is Mike Schwartzwald. Mr. Schwartzwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Schwartzwald. My wife, Laura, and I are the pharmacist co-founders of GuidePoint Pharmacy. We're a group of small, locally owned pharmacies located throughout Minnesota, mainly in rural areas. I'd like to thank Representative Bonner for the work she's done helping get pharmacies to get paid so we can continue the health services to give to our patients that they've come to rely on. A little background, we've been pharmacists for 34 years, pharmacy owners for 21 years, so we know it's important to go beyond just filling prescriptions to serve our patients in our communities. I just have a couple examples. One of the pharmacies we have is in the town of Longville. It's a town of 153 people. The town cannot support a full-time pharmacist, but because it's a telepharmacy, we can have a pharmacist there one day a week, and I'm the pharmacist that goes up there. The demand for immunizations have been so great that at a couple points, our waiting list for immunizations were up to 2 months long. During the pandemic, we administered over 900 COVID vaccines to that location, and luckily, with help from the University of Minnesota and other universities, I had students that helped because I would not have been able to keep up any other way. It would be nice to have our technician who would be trained that would work right by my side to help co-administer vaccines that would help, that would allow more people to get the necessary services in a timely fashion. We've seen that especially during the pandemic, there are many patients with uncontrolled mental health illnesses. These patients could benefit from medications such as long-acting injectable antipsychotics, but there's not enough providers in many of these rural areas to administer them. Pharmacists are well-suited and we've got pharmacists trained to give these long-acting injectables. We can legally administer them, but we have no way to get them paid for their administration, which is unrealistic. We don't normally make money on the medications because we're often reimbursed below cost. And if I can't get paid for the administration, it's an unsustainable service. Those are just a couple examples from our experience about how critical it is to provide enhanced services to our patients and to be reimbursed for those efforts so that they may continue. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartzwald. Our last testifier is Matt Schaefer from Medica. Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm the Government Relations Director for Medica, a Minnesota-based health plan serving members in 11 states. Although today I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, I want to begin by thanking the author as well as the proponents for engaging us early in a dialogue and the continued discussions around House File 4008. Members of the Council raised a number of operational questions and considerations, which the proponents were kind enough to incorporate into the bill as part of the A5 amendment, and I'll touch on a couple of those briefly. If you look at the language modifications in sections 1 and 3, those came because, as members of the committee are aware, a number of health plans have what are called value-based payment arrangements. That's how these are agreements we enter with providers where we're really seeking to incentivize quality outcomes as opposed to the traditional fee-for-service model. And so we're hoping that those changes in definition would allow to at some point incorporate the role of pharmacists into that mechanism. We also requested some language in what is currently Section 8 with the intent of ensuring there's open lines of communication between regulators and stakeholders as this change in payment model is rolled out. This will hopefully facilitate a process where all stakeholders have a place to address any questions, considerations the team may have. For example, do we want to reimburse via pharmacist ID or pharmacy ID? Are there, as they go through the credentialing process, what operational considerations do we have to have on our respective radars? And of course, if there is an arrangement, say, between a pharmacy chain and a PBM to reimburse for the pharmacy benefit through the pharmacy benefit for like through 2027, this law goes into effect in 2024. how do we want to reconcile those pieces? So there's a number of operational questions. We just want to make sure that there's a space to get those resolved and ensure a smooth implementation, solve all those issues on the front end. We also really appreciate moving the effective date to 1/1/24. If we're given the chance to do something right versus doing it right now, and we think those might be two different things, we're always going to ask if we can do it right. And we do think in getting those operational pieces ironed out, giving us some time to make sure we can do everything we can on our end to ensure a smooth implementation to be a good thing. Last, I want to echo the comments that the other testifiers made on the public health benefit, particularly as it relates to vaccine administration. We know that when you can make the healthy choice the easy choice, you're going to have better outcomes. Therefore, if we can increase access to vaccines, we're going to increase uptake, and that's going to slow the spread of disease, and we typically support that. So I will close with close the way I opened in thanking the author and the proponents, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. That concludes public testimony. We will now move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a question of Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Schaefer, you know, will this bill, you know, I kind of view this a little bit as a health insurance mandate. Do you see there a potential for this bill to drive up the cost of health insurance premiums to Minnesotans?
Mr. Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Matt Rasmussen. As we view this legislation, what it looks like we're doing is as the scope of practice of pharmacists have continued to evolve, there's a number of administration practices that currently might be covered under the payment benefit, although as we've heard from the other testifiers, maybe that's not always taking place. And there's been a national trend. I think about a half dozen states have passed laws that are migrating a number of those administration services over to the medical side of the house. And so they'll be reimbursed through the medical side as opposed to as part of the pharmacy benefit. The impact on costs, that's a good question, Representative. I don't know that I have a solid answer for you. Ostensibly, these are things that are probably getting paid through the pharmacy side that would now be getting paid through the medical side.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. So just to be clear, administering medication is generally a covered service already. So that isn't actually driving up any cost anywhere. The only difference here is who's actually administering the medication, whether it's a pharmacy or being done in a clinic. If you're doing it in a clinic setting, I might want to add that under those circumstances, you may also be paying a fee for a clinic visit as well as additional fees. So potentially, if we're doing this in a pharmacy setting, we are potentially actually making it more cost effective to payers to be able to have it done through that venue.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Schaefer and Representative Bonner. An additional follow-up question. Does this bill only cover the fully insured market in Minnesota, or would it apply to those that are self-insured or getting covered through public programs? And Mr. Chair, I don't know if Representative Bonner, Mr. Schaefer, or someone else wants to take that question.
Well, I'll certainly give Representative Bonner the first crack, though I think ERISA preemption might be the answer, at least for the self-insured piece of it. So Representative Bonner?
Yeah, I believe so as well, but I do believe we may have someone on the line who can better speak to that particular piece.
Okay. Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, if you look at Section 6 of the bill, I believe that speaks to coverage of services under public programs, and I think I see somebody from DHS who can probably also offer some additional insight.
Okay. I see we have a few people from DHS on the line. Do any of them want to speak to this? Mr. Hope, I see you're unmuted. Ms. Bops?
Good afternoon, sure. Chair Stevenson. My name is Chad Hope, Deputy Director for Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS. This bill, while the language would be inclusive of public programs, we've met with the author and the advocates, and they have confirmed that this actually wouldn't change any benefits that are currently covered by DHS, as we currently cover pharmacists that are operating within the scope of their license.
Thank you, Mr. Hope. Representative Rasmussen, any additional follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any further questions, but I'm just always, you know, concerned, and it won't surprise any members of this committee, that I'm just always concerned when we're looking at adding additional health insurance mandates that, you know, especially as the state of Minnesota only apply to a small percentage of the overall insured market. And so I'm just worried about what that could potentially mean in terms of increased costs for health insurance for Minnesotans and employers. But I appreciate the conversation and the response to my questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Patisa Batu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this bill forward. My sister-in-law is a pharmacist, and she actually had sent me an article from a national publication months ago about this challenge. And obviously, it's impacting pharmacies across the country and also here across the state. But I think one of the testifiers did touch on a little bit the challenges that pharmacies have been having, small, locally owned pharmacies, particularly in greater Minnesota, about being bought up by larger chains or having to close. And I think that this is one step that we can take to really support them and continue supporting Minnesotans having access to health professionals much closer than they may have to, closer than they would have if a local pharmacy does close. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. I appreciate the advocates' work on this. And I think it's a step in the right direction, even though it might only cover a small percentage of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Bonner, any closing comments?
Yeah. Well, I just want to kind of swing back around to this. First of all, there is no unfunded mandate or no mandate here. We're simply asking that individuals or businesses who deliver services get paid for them. I don't think there's any business owner in the state who would have the expectation, if they are fully credentialed to deliver services and they deliver said services, that they should not be paid for their work. I mean, that's pretty common sense, straightforward policy. And so I just want to be clear that that's really what this bill does, is make sure that those folks who are delivering the services are paid for them and that they're paid consistently without having those held up. This is really a lot about access across the state. Many of the folks who are getting these services are doing so in small independent pharmacies across Minnesota, particularly in rural areas, in urban areas. Without these pharmacies, a lot of these folks would not have access to care. So we want to make sure that the health of these pharmacies is strong and that they can continue to deliver those services for years to come.
Thank you. And so with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4008, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, pass.
Representative Barr.
Aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Davney.
Davney, aye.
Davney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Haley, aye. Representative Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, yes.
Lucero, aye. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, aye.
Farr, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, aye.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Lilly.
With 16 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails, and House File 4008, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Bonner. The next item on our agenda today is House File 2711. Welcome to the committee, Representative Wasilik. I will move that House File 2711 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Representative Wasilik, I understand that you have a DE amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I will move the DE1 amendment. Since this is a DE, we'll assume this is the basis to get the bill in the shape you want the committee to consider it. Any discussion to my motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. The motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Wasilik, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 2711 with the DE amendment represents an agreement between stakeholders who have been working on this issue for several months. It provides for a notice to be given by homeowners associations to homeowners of their rights and responsibilities when a fine or assessment is imposed. It also informs the homeowner of their right under existing law to dispute the charge and have a hearing before them. While homeowners are given and expected to read the declaration, bylaws, and rules and regulations of the association when they become homeowners, many folks do not realize that assessments and fines become liens by operation of law. It's often a surprise to homeowners when they realize that even if their mortgage is current or paid off, that the association can initiate a foreclosure and the homeowner could lose their unit. So this notice would tell the homeowner the reason for the fine or assessment, the specific bylaw or rule that was allegedly violated, the right to dispute the fine or assessment and have a hearing, that if the assessment or fine goes unpaid, it could lead to foreclosure, and then offering a referral to the Homeownership Center as a resource to help resolve the dispute and avoid foreclosure. I wanna thank the Community Association Institute, otherwise known as CAI, which represents homeowners associations for working collaboratively with other stakeholders to come to agreement on this language that is before you today. You'll notice the DE was quite a difference from the original bill language. There are still sort of more complex issues to work out, but this is one important step that we can take now to help better inform homeowners and hopefully avert unnecessary foreclosures.
Thank you, Representative Wasilik. We'll move to the testimony and Mr. Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I really want to thank Representative Wasilik for carrying the bill. And I also want to thank the Community Association Institute for working so collaboratively with us to get this language before you today. Legal Aid has been working on foreclosure issues and working with a variety of advocacy and industry partners on it over the years, and we passed a variety of laws to avert foreclosures. This is really one of those bills, but it's a little different because it involves homeowners associations, because historically we've been working on foreclosures of mortgages, but Legal Aid actually has many clients who find themselves in the unfortunate situation in a homeowners association context, facing foreclosure of their units after a dispute. A number of our clients are seniors, actually, who are eligible for our services. But working with our colleagues at the Home Ownership Center, whom you'll also hear from in a minute, and they also work on foreclosure issues, among the issues we identified to help avert this problem is the lack of knowledge, as Representative Wasilik noted. And most people do not understand that a dispute, an unresolved dispute with a homeowner association could actually lead to the loss of their homes. You know, our dialogue with the Community Association Institute has been characterized by mutually respectful discussions and an effort for each of us to learn and appreciate the perspective of the other. And we look forward to continuing to work with them in the future to find more ways to avert foreclosures in these situations and ensure that homeowners associations can fulfill their responsibility to adequately maintain common ownership communities for the benefit of all. We support House File 2711 and urge its passage by the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. The next testifier is Julie Gugan. Ms. Gugan.
Hello, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Julie Gugan. I'm president of the nonprofit Minnesota Home Ownership Center. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of House File 2711. The Homeownership Center believes that owning a home is the foundation for personal and community success. For over 25 years, we've worked to educate buyers on the complicated process of owning and sustaining a home. We've carried out this work by partnering with community-based organizations throughout the state to offer unbiased homebuyer education, advising, and foreclosure prevention services. In our role as an intermediary, we also engage in other efforts to drive equitable access to sustainable homeownership, like monitoring and advocating on behalf of consumers and owners' rights on issues like homeowner associations. In our work, we encounter owners facing a variety of legal actions, including foreclosure, brought by their association board of directors. A common concern among owners is a lack of understanding of the board's actions. What did I do wrong? Why was I not notified? They've put a lien on my property and I don't know why. This can be coupled with an unwillingness on the part of the board of directors to offer a meaningful, timely response. Rather, boards commonly refer owners to the association's attorneys for clarification, which causes the owner, not the association, to incur legal fees. We recently worked with an owner who lost his home to foreclosure by the association. The first he had learned of a significant assessment that the association had levied was when the association placed a lien on his property, giving him a short period of time to pay the significant amount of the assessment. Unable to secure the funds on short notice, he lost his home of 18 years. House File 2711 will ensure that owners are given proper notice and consideration as they strive to understand and work with their associations, while ensuring that association boards can reasonably transact the business of running their associations. I acknowledge the Community Associations Institute and their cooperation in crafting this bill. We look forward to many more opportunities to work together to ensure that owners' rights and interests are contemplated in common interest communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last testifier is Christy Hoffman. Ms. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Christy Hoffman, and I am the chairperson of the Minnesota chapter of the CAI Legislative Action Committee, and I'm also the president of Association Management at Gas & Company. Gas & Company provides professional management to over 230 home associations in the Twin Cities metro area. Today, I would like to provide some information about the impact that non-paying homeowners can have on a homeowners association. Homeowners associations are nonprofit corporations, and they have fixed expenses each month, such as utilities, lawn and snow contracts, their master insurance policy, reserve funding, and variable expenses, such as building maintenance. And we're seeing really sharp increases in many of the expenses that home associations must pay each month, including 20 to 30% increases in lawn and snow contracts due to staff shortages, 20, 30, or even 40% increases in their master insurance policies due to the large number of wind hail claims in Minnesota. These increases, unfortunately, lead to higher association dues. Board members understand they have homeowners that are on fixed incomes. They have homeowners with tight budgets. However, they also understand they have a fiscal responsibility to make sure they have the funds available to pay their monthly bills. The increase in expenses means association dues must go up, and board members understand the impact that has on their homeowners, and they don't take that responsibility lightly. We currently manage an association that is experiencing the impact of non-paying homeowners. The board of this association did not want to cause additional stress for their delinquent homeowners, so they elected not to send the homeowners' accounts to their attorney for collection. I understand how difficult the decision is for a board member to turn over a neighbor to an attorney for collections. Unfortunately, the association now has three delinquent accounts, and the association is owed around $24,000 in past assessments and fees. At this time, the association cannot pay their monthly bills. Their snow vendor has not been paid in 2 months. They've stopped funding their reserve account, and they'll default on an association loan in 5 months because they will have depleted their operating account by that time. The only option is to special assess all the owners to bridge the income gap, and they must continue trying to collect the past due delinquent accounts through the legal system, not to cause undue stress on the homeowner, but to keep the association in good financial standing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. This concludes our testimony. We will now move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll, do you want to go first? Or do you want to defer to your colleague?
Mr. Chair, I will wrap for our team. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple questions. Being a lead on housing, a little bit of this is kind of confusing to me. We make such a big deal about doing evictions when people don't pay you their rent. So I'm a little bit confused on this part of it. Could you explain for sure, because just in the DE, I'm not seeing, what is the definition of unit?
Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if that definition is in there or if it's somewhere else in the statutes that deal with community interest with these communities. So I don't see it in there either, but I see Mr. Elwood has...
He's raising his actual hand. Now he's got his virtual hand up, but he was raising his actual hand a minute ago, which was kind of fun. Representative Elwood. Mr. Elwood, he's the 135th member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tice, I know sometimes it gets confusing when you take a little slice of the bigger picture. And so actually, this is a very, very, very long chapter of law. 515B is the common interest ownership chapter. And the definition of unit owner is in a different section of definitions.
Representative Tice?
Well, it still doesn't tell me. What are we talking about? Are we talking about townhomes, apartments, that type of thing?
Yeah,
I just want to make sure I'm on the same page with this.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, yes, these are condo associations, basically. So they're units in a condo association.
Representative Tice.
Thank you. I guess I'm just a little bit surprised that we don't have anything, especially in the light of the pandemic, to help folks out with their association, homeowner association fees. Is there anything available to help them with it? And I'm pretty sure I'm going to hear from somebody, but yeah.
I'd like to know
a little bit more about that as well.
Ms. Guggen.
Chair, Representative Tice, all of the homeownership preservation programs that my organization has been managing for about the past year or so allow consumers to use funds from the programs to pay homeowner association dues. So for my organization, that means Hennepin County, including Minneapolis, Ramsey County, including St. Paul, Dakota County, and soon to be Bloomington. For the rest of the state, there are not currently resources that I'm aware of unless local jurisdictions have implemented something. The state's Housing Finance Agency is in the process of rolling out the Home Help MN program. It's my understanding that they intend, and that will be statewide, and it's my understanding that they intend to allow homeowner association dues to be paid from that program.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably, I'm guessing, for one of the testifiers. Did we see an uptick in this since the whole COVID shutdown happened? Or is this something that's been happening for a while and we just haven't heard about it?
Representative Wasilik, did you want to answer that, or I can ask Mr. Elwood?
Yeah, it looks like Mr. Elwood unmuted, so he can provide some information.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, I think we've seen an uptick of these. It's actually, the answer to your question is both. I think that the situation of foreclosures in these housing situations have been too much for too long. And, you know, it's not necessarily the homeowners association's fault, but it certainly is a situation that has been ongoing for a long time. Like most situations, I think the pandemic exacerbated that situation. So that's where we are. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Tice?
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's just a little hard sometimes to wrap your head around it that, you know, they're keeping up with their mortgage, and yet I know they're not, you know, they're not staying current with their HOA, but to think somebody could lose their home because of it still is a little concerning when we're fighting so hard to make sure that we're housing everyone. But I appreciate the opportunity to make some statements. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tyson. I did, while this conversation was going on, I did a little digging because I was curious about the definition of unit. And you can find it if you're looking in Minnesota Statute 515B.1-103, and it's paragraph 35 in that document. It says, means a portion of a common interest community, the boundaries of which are described in the common interest community's declaration, and which is intended for separate ownership or separate occupancy pursuant to a proprietary lease. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things that I've got concerns about here today on this proposed piece of legislation. Number one, in the state of Minnesota, under common interest community laws, a purchase agreement must contain a separate addendum or section in the contract that talks about the homeowner's rights, responsibilities, and obligations. They're also required to receive a copy of the declaration, the rules, the bylaws, and any other pertinent documents, finance, whether or not the association is subject to litigation, and so forth as a disclosure. That also allows the person who's looking to purchase said property a 10-day right of rescission to back out of the agreement and get full return of earnest money. That bill was passed in 1994 here in the state of Minnesota. The challenge that we have now is we're introducing yet another time frame in here that's not consistent with a 10-day. So I suspect there'll be a confusion in the marketplace between what a 10-day right of rescission is and a 15-day notice period. So I don't know that we're helping consumers with that particular addition on here. I'm very interested when I see lines in the DE amendment, lines 3.23 through 3.25, where it says no attorney fees shall be chargeable to the unit owner for a period of 15 days during the 15-day period. Well, if that homeowner has been paying their association fees on behalf of the association, the attorney is involved in litigation, are we prorating back that portion of the that homeowner's fees that they would have paid that would have been used in litigation on that? Because it doesn't talk about that. And I'm sure someone will say, well, no, that means that they themselves as the unit owner can't be charged. But actually, the amendment doesn't differentiate that. The other thing that I have a concern about on here is that there are lots of things that can happen to a property owner or someone in the CIC. There could be other assessments, non-payment of taxes that could affect what's going on. Are we going to be back here in a couple of years now talking to people about, well, if you don't make your mortgage payments, that could be subject to foreclosure, and that could also have an impact on the association. This is opening up a wide swath of stuff that I don't think that we intend to do here in the state of Minnesota. It's only going to be get additional bills like this to talk about failure to pay other types of association fees or assessments, or maybe we should do it in residential. That doesn't even get into how we deal with co-ops where there's no actual ownership of the property and you're in a situation where it's personal property that you have with a proprietary lease to occupy the unit. So lots of problems with this bill, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to be a no today. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I see no other members seeking recognition. So Representative Wasilewicz, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to have a discussion on this piece of legislation. I think it's an important step we can take to Representative Tice's point to making sure that people have housing. We know that's a really important piece of pretty much everything, especially with kids and families. And so wanting to make sure that folks are able to understand a process. And as somebody who has an HOA myself, I can tell you I got those documents, and one of them is it's a giant book, and it's typed from a typewriter, and it's photocopied, and it's not great. So as somebody who is receiving those documents, I do think that anything we can do to ensure that homeowners have the information they need to make sure that they're able to stay in their homes is important. So hope that folks can support the bill. Thank you.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2711, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotizo Watoon.
Aye.
Cotizo Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Barr.
No.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Daphne.
Daphne, aye.
Daphne, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
Tice, no. And Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, no.
O'Driscoll, no.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 2711, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. The next file on our agenda today is House File 3154. Welcome to the committee, Representative Agbaje. I will move that House File 3154 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Agbaje, I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that amendment. Do you want me to describe it now?
I will move the A1 amendment, and then you can describe it. Okay. So go ahead.
So it basically just adds a couple of words to make it clarified that this is about third-party liability renter's insurance, and that we're not infringing upon first-party insurance of the property owner.
Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Agbaje, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. House File 3154 is a bill that creates parity within rental insurance offerings regarding third-party liability. The bill addresses a discrepancy between rental insurance policy offerings. Most, if not all, rental insurance policies offer coverage for negligent fire damage. That is, if you start a fire or if a fire gets out of your control and damages another unit or the general building, your own insurance as a renter can cover the cost of that damage to pay back the landlord. In the instance of negligent water damage, like a tub or a sink overflowing, or more commonly, pipes bursting, most rental insurance does not cover this negligent damage. Yet the same type of liability can be attributed to the tenant in those situations, and they would have nothing to fall back on to help them pay those costs. Certain insurance companies already do this type of business in Minnesota, and they offer to cover fire, water, and other damage for renters, but it's not something that a renter can easily shop for. Most renters would not know to look for this provision, and this bill helps remedy that by ensuring that all renters are buying similar basic products when it comes to the third-party liability insurance for their rental unit. To offer more insight about this bill is my testifier, Paul Bierman.
Hello, good afternoon. I hope you can hear me. To put it mildly, I'm not a Zoom expert, and so I hope that things go okay. I'm a retired attorney. Excuse me?
So far, so good.
Well, that's good. I try to join the modern world. I'm a retired attorney. In 2019, I retired from Homeline, a nonprofit tenant advocacy agency. One of my duties there was to handle hotline calls about renter's insurance. There were basically two categories of those calls, as Representative Bajay hinted at. One, the tenant would call because he'd accidentally started a fire, for example, by careless cooking or careless candle use. He badly damaged his rental apartment. His landlord sent him a legitimate bill for the damage, often tens of thousands of dollars. I'd review his renter's insurance policy. In every case, he was covered for what he owed. Category two, that tenant accidentally froze pipes by leaving a window open or turning on the thermostat a bit too far. The pipes burst and there was water everywhere. His landlord would send him a legitimate bill for the damage to his apartment, again, often for tens of thousands of dollars. I reviewed his renter's insurance policy. His renter's insurance did not cover what he owed because of an exclusion for non-fire damage to his apartment, very deep in a policy that ran about 30 pages. Every client of mine in that category was out of luck. This bill fixes this water versus fire glitch. So after retiring, I researched renter's insurance policies posted on the Department of Commerce website. Well, none of my clients' policies provided water damage. About a quarter of the renter's policies filed with the Department of Commerce do cover water damage, and about 3% cover all damage. So again, this problem needs to be fixed. Next point, the market won't solve this problem. Only a very sophisticated tenant even knows this is a problem when he buys renter's insurance, so it just doesn't get asked about. Even my own established expert insurance agent didn't know about the problem until I explained it to him. Basically, it's the luck of the draw if the tenant is covered and the odds are against him. I think the bill is unlikely to have much effect on premiums. First, the really big payouts on renters' policies are for fires. And the more common payouts are for first-party claims, theft, damage to the tenant's own possessions, et cetera. Both of these events are already covered by all policies. Secondly, these policies are often sold as loss leaders bundled with auto policies. I did a quick study of premiums for 9 policies that I could get premiums for. 6 of them were fire-only policies. 3 of them were water plus fire policies. So actually, to my surprise, the 6 fire-only policies average $18.78 a month in premium, while the 3 water plus fire policies average $13.42 a month. That is, the premiums were lower for the better coverage in my small study. Respecting the committee's time constraint, I've tried to be brief. More details are in my written testimony, including links to the policies I obtained from the Commerce Department website. And of course, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'm glad to hear that I passed my first class in Zoom.
You sure did. The next testifier is Aaron Cocking. Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Aaron Cocking, President and CEO, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Bajay for the discussions we've had so far on this bill and what she wants to accomplish. Despite those conversations, I want to raise a couple of concerns that we have with this bill. First, at a high level, we oppose any underwriting restrictions or coverage mandates that are added to state law. The rental insurance market is working and should be allowed to work. Minnesota has the 49th cheapest renter's insurance premium on average of all 50 states. The average annual premium is roughly $140. Insurers should be allowed to tailor their products to meet the demands of the state, and any mandate only adds costs because it removes tools and options a company can use to best serve their policyholders. Added costs lead to higher rates and higher premiums. On this bill specifically, it is unnecessary because almost all current renters policies already include liability insurance. Renters insurance policies are intended to cover 3 main things. First, it provides coverage for personal property. Personal property are the things that you would have in your home, furniture, clothes, dishes, et cetera. Think of personal property as stuff. So it covers your stuff. Second, renters policies cover additional living expenses. These are the added costs that you would incur in the event that your home or unit had a loss that made it uninhabitable for a period of time. Third, and perhaps most important, into this bill, it provides liability protection. Liability insurance is a coverage that pays out if you are financially responsible for damage to a person or their property. The notion of liability is critical as we proceed in this bill. This is not first-party coverage, as Representative Agbaje mentioned. In order to have liability, though, you have to prove the required elements. You have to have a legal duty to the harmed party under the circumstances, a breach of that duty, causation, meaning action or inaction that caused damage, and then damages, where someone was harmed as a result of those actions. Those elements must be present to have the liability coverage triggered. A freezing pipe in a unit that was kept at 65 degrees, but the wind was blowing through lightly insulated walls and freezes the pipe does not trigger liability coverage. The policyholder didn't cause the actions that led to the damage. While an overwhelming majority of renters' policies cover liability insurance, the few that don't might be doing so because of some recent changes in Minnesota case law. There appears to be a shift on the part of landlords in their leases to require tenants to bear a larger share of liability than would normally be expected. This bill could throw into question the currently decided precedents of how liabilities are allocated in negotiations between landlords and tenants, as well as the subrogation rights that have been settled by the Minnesota Supreme Court. In the interest of time, Mr. Chairman, I won't go through the decisions by the Minnesota Supreme Court and what effect this would have on current practice. However, mandating third-party coverage could result in a court considering that a tenant's third-party liability coverage is applicable to a loss that would be more appropriately handled by the landlord's commercial liability policy, and that could lead to a cost shift from landlords to tenants. If the need for this legislation is in response to landlords requiring a tenant to purchase third-party liability insurance, in part in response to the court rulings, it would make more sense to explore those requirements of what a landlord could require in the landlord tenancy laws. This bill also leads to a disparity between those who have renter's insurance and those that don't. The responsibility or the liability doesn't go away as a result of having or not having insurance. It means that when someone has this coverage, the insurer will step in and pay for the damage they caused. Uninsured renters are still on the hook for the damage they caused, but they don't have the protection of insurance. We want to increase the number of people who are covered by renter's insurance. Currently, 37% of renters have renter's insurance. That is despite this being less than $12 per month. And I understand that for people that don't have 12 extra dollars, it might as well be $100 or $1,000. But doing more to raise the cost of this insurance is not in anyone's best interest. Finally, there seems to be a belief that if this bill passes, any damage to a rented unit would allow an insured to file with their insurer and receive payment. Under liability coverage, even if the elements for negligence are shown, payment will never be made to the first party policyholder. The payment for damages will always go to the harmed third party. I think that's critical. I'm happy to continue to work with Representative Agbaje to address what she wants to fix, but we don't believe this is the bill to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kake. This concludes public testimony on the bill. We will now move to member questions and discussion. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would be to Mr. Kake. And so I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, and I appreciate those remarks and detailed information there from Mr. Kock. So Mr. Kock, did I hear you correctly that if this bill were to become law, it would likely increase the current cost of renter's insurance, thereby potentially making it less affordable for those who can least afford it? And under that scenario, if they can't afford it, they might choose not to go with insurance whatsoever. And if there is a potential disaster whereby their private property or their personal property, I should say, is damaged, they would be even a further negative scenario.
Mr. Cocker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, yes, I think there's a potential of that. I'm not saying because, as I stated early on, most of these policies already cover the damage that we're talking about. So in those instances, we're not going to see a premium increase. But to the extent that we're moving in a direction where renters' policies are expected to take on a greater share or greater coverage than kind of originally would have been anticipated with the coverage, naturally, the more losses that are paid out in any line, you're going to see a cost increase.
Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, well, whether it be to them, the policyholders, or as the insurance industry as a whole, an increase in payout increases the premiums on every single one of us. So if this bill were to become law, it only increases the costs on a smaller pool or on a larger pool, all of us. I oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Agbaje, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Appreciate the discussion. I think there are a number of assumptions that are being had here. First of all, renter's insurance is pretty much required in the majority of the rental industry. If you are a renter, you are most likely to be asked to purchase insurance before you can continue living on the property. I would also say, as Mr. Bierenberg noted, the prices are relatively the same between policies that have this and policies that don't. We're just trying to create a system where people are protected and they're not surprised. So I would ask for the committee's support in this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Agbaje. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3154, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register, and Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, no.
O'Driscoll, no. Representative Barr.
No.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Listlegard.
Listlegard, aye.
Listlegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3154 is recommended to be, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Our next file on the agenda is House File 4030. Welcome to the committee, Representative Gomez. I will move House File 4030 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Gomez, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing this incredibly important bill today. It's about the regulation of bullion, which is not something you make soup with. It is products that contain precious metals like silver, gold, platinum, palladium, or other. So basically, there was a recent court case that struck down parts of Minnesota statute in Chapter 80G. Basically, we were regulating transactions that didn't take place in Minnesota. So the main thing that this does, if you look at the second page, starting on line 2.19, is it really defines what a Minnesota transaction is with respect to gold bullion, and then sprinkles it throughout the chapter. So that's the bill. It responds to some recent litigation and just kind of gets us in alignment with what the court ordered. And I have some folks from the Department of Commerce who will answer questions if your members have any.
Chair Gomez, I would have always calendared this bill if I knew it was dealing with the soup. I when you said it's not with the soup, I don't know. I'm distressed.
I mean, I know that soup regulation is one of the main charges of the Commerce Committee. But...
Yes. Okay. Thank you. We have two testifiers signed to testify. First, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Gomez for carrying the bill. As the representative aptly said, this non-soup bill she cleans up the regulation of bullion coin in both product dealer and coin statutes, ADG. It also makes some other tweaks that relate to the court case. It removes an exemption that is in section one of the bill. The court found that that also violated the Dormant Commerce Clause. So rather than expand it to out of state, the department determined to just get rid of the entire exemption. There also were some small additions that brought consistency into the statute and made language references consistent. This is something that we are doing in response to the court case to make it Minnesota specific, but this is an important regulation that the department does to benefit consumers, whether they are buyers or sellers in financial transactions involving bullion coin. And with that, I stand available for member questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. The next testifier is Thomas Stasinski. I hope I got your name correct there, sir.
Thank you. You were pretty close. Thank you, Chairman Stevenson. My name is Tom Stachinski, and I'm an information security specialist for a large financial institution. And what I do for fun on the weekends is I like to go to coin shows, and I often set up at coin shows. I have a real passion for coins. I love coins. They're my happy place. And one of the things that really bothers me is when I see consumers being taken advantage of, and you know, they may not have the knowledge that I have, but they may have that same desire and love of coins, and they can often be exploited by telemarketers, which is what the bill was originally designed to prevent. Now, I've asked, or when the bill was originally going through, I suggested that we put in an exemption for coin shows. And the reason is because coin shows are the best defense against telemarketers who are ripping off consumers. And the reason is that the telemarketer or a coin show has multiple dealers. There's monthly coin shows that typically have 20 dealers. Last weekend, I was at a coin show that had 100 dealers. And what it does is it allows the customers to go to different dealers to shop around to gain knowledge. Many times, and I bet every single dealer at that show can tell you a story of when a customer came to them with some product that they purchased on from a telemarketer, and we're the ones that are left to break the news that they were ripped off. And sometimes it's like to the factor of like tenfold. So that's the reason for the coin show exemption that was originally put into the law. And I would like to, if I may, go through the history in more detail about this coin show exemption. In interest of full disclosure, I am the lead plaintiff on the lawsuit that the Department of Commerce is talking about.
Okay, well, I have to, we are limited in time. We have one more bill to get through today. So you can continue for a little longer, but I don't know that we have time for the full history of that exemption. We only have 20 minutes left in the hearing. We have one more bill after this one to get to. So,
okay. If you don't mind, give me just a couple seconds to just kind of figure out what is the best things to discuss. The Department of Commerce, there was an issue with the original wording of the trade show exemption, and there was kind of a disagreement with what occasional trade show meant. The legislator later clarified that to change it to say 12 trade shows in the state of Minnesota. Shortly after that, the Department of Commerce, they didn't like some of the things that I had pointed out in the legislation when that bill was going through. They were working with one of those crooked telemarketers. And after the bill passed, but before it went into the Department of Commerce came after me issued a cease and desist order against me, saying I didn't respond to their subpoena, saying that I was doing too many coin shows, even though there was no set standard at the time. I spent $50,000 on a lawyer to defend myself in front of the Department of Commerce. Ultimately, a state court judge ruled in my favor and said that I did not violate the subpoena, and said I was fine with a number of shows, and I didn't violate it in any way. So then later we ended up looking at the law, and the law was terribly written, and it kind of opened the eyes. This whole case opened the eyes to my lawyer of just how badly written the law is. And that's what ended up happening with that lawsuit. But just to sum up, I know we're short on time. So the coin show exemption, the issue with the coin show exemption is that if you were in, if I as a dealer, I could do 12 shows, but they were restricted to the state of Minnesota. If I did one show outside of the state of Minnesota, then I would have to register. And that was a dormant commerce clause violation. Now, when the court ruled on that particular line item, she fixed it very easily. The federal court judge just struck in Minnesota. So the result of the new statute is I can still stay under the exemption doing 12 shows, but I can do one in Wisconsin. One of the 12 shows can now be done in Wisconsin. And that's the change that was made. So I don't think we need to strike the whole measure on the coin show exemption. I think we just need to make that small change there. And the judge already did that, and the Department of Commerce did not appeal that decision. And with that, I know you don't have a lot of time. I'll conclude my remarks. I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stachinski. We have no further public testimony, so we'll move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 4030 be recommended to be placed in the general register. Representative Gomez, any closing comments?
Thank you for hearing the bill today. I hope to never know what the Dormant Commerce Clause means, but I would, I'm glad we're aligning with it now. So thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, no.
O'Driscoll, no. Representative Barr.
No.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Kegel.
Kegel, aye.
Kegel, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
I got it.
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 4030 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Chair Gomez. The last bill on our agenda today is House File 3345. Representative Farr, would you like to move your bill? You are muted, Representative Farr. Are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3345. Are we going to move this to the general register?
That is the motion that I have on my sheet here. So Representative Farr moves House File 3345 be recommended be placed on the general register. And Representative Farr, I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, I have a D2. I'd like to move that amendment to get it in the shape I'd like.
Okay, Representative Farr moves the DE2 amendment. Any discussion to that amendment, to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Farr, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill proposes some definitional changes to licensee education, particularly in the areas of insurance, real estate, and appraisal licensing and continuing education. So years ago when I took my insurance exam, I did it in person, took the course, had the instructor proctor the exam. But of course, during the past couple of years, we've all adjusted to different delivery methods for education to include our committee work, and licensee education has been no different. So what 3345 does is offers definitions for live courses, which includes instructor-led courses, whether online or in person, and the requirements for that course delivery. It also further defines demand courses, on-demand courses, which are on-learning or courses which enable students to complete the course on their own timeline. Lastly, because the instructor is not often on-site during this educational process, it defines the parameters for who can be a proctor for the licensee. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have a testifier.
Thank you, Representative Farr. Yes, we have Mr. Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce. Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. My thanks to Representative Farr. This bill, as amended with the DE2, reflects the product of a work group that the department convened last fall that spent its time looking at ways to improve the CE requirements in Chapter 45. And our organizing principles were not to change any of the substantive requirements currently in the law, but rather to make the law easier to understand for all users, reduce confusion about the existing requirements, and to make life easier for all actors within the CE ecosystem to operate. Representative Farr teed it up quite nicely. I'm happy to walk through details if members are interested in it. But I just wanted to note that that group included representatives from the Realtors Association, Commercial Realtors Association, the independent insurance agents, appraisers, and CE providers, both big and small, instructors and coordinators. Our hope will be is that the law will be a little bit more plain language. There will not be any reduction in quality of the education that is offered to licensees that the department administers. And lastly, because I know that Representative Davids is watching this hearing, as he does every Commerce Committee hearing, I would note that this bill requires no additional continuing education hours for any licensee in the state. With that, Mr. Chair, ask for member support and happy to stand for questions.
Thank you. Mr. Brickwitty, there are no further public testimonies, so we will move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Representative O'Driscoll, I thought you might want to speak on this one. I was waiting just for you.
Mr. Chair, it might not actually be what you're thinking about. I'm just wondering if this bill has anything to do with pharmaceuticals, homeowners associations, bullion renters, insurance, or if it's strictly just to license education.
Representative Farr.
So to answer that question, the bill has nothing to do with soup, Representative O'Driscoll.
Another one with nothing to do with soup. Mr. Brown and I are going to have a serious conversation about the bills that we are scheduling in this committee, because clearly we are just failing on this front. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thought this was a perfect time to bring up the fact that this was Representative Farr's first bill before Commerce. And we are not getting treats. So it's about time we start meeting in person so that we can get our treats, so that we can feel like he's fully been vetted and initiated. And that's all I got to say on that.
Well, thank Representative Tice, you will be relieved to know that in the Commerce Committee, because we regulate financial institutions, we do believe in a reasonable rate of return and interest is charged. And because Representative Dabney's excellent payday lending bill capping interest rates has not yet passed into law because of some opposition from members of this panel, among others, the interest rates are quite high. Now, that really doesn't do you much good, I think, since you will be going to the other chamber next year when we are back in person. But for the rest of us, Representative Farr and others, it's going to be really tough next year how much they're going to have to pay in treats to make up for the fact that they weren't here this year. Representative Dabney.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if this is a question for you or for Representative Tice, but perhaps for Representative Farr as well. Would soup qualify as a treat?
Representative Tice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. It really could.
Okay.
Chicken wild rice soup, I love it. Ooh, actually, yeah, French onion too. Good. Yeah, that it could be good. A treat.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Driscoll. Well, Mr. Chair, I know that we are having a good time with one of our freshmen this afternoon, and I must tell you that it's good to once again have the committee have some fun. It is what keeps us coming back and working on the people's business. So thank you for the opportunity, and for Representative Farr for having the opportunity to have your first bill. And the chair is right. We do have a lot of inflation and rising interest rates, and so it will be rather punitive for you when we get together next year. So I would start early and be taking soup orders if I was you.
Very good advice. I see no further discussion. Representative Farr, any closing comments?
Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you. No further question or comments. Mr. Chair, I think I've had enough.
All right. With that, Representative Farr renews his motion that House File 3345 is amended, be recommended, be placed in the general register. And Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
I'd like to pass, but I'm going to vote for his bill. Five O'Driscoll votes yes.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Carlson.
Aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Haley, aye. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, yes.
Lucero, aye. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, aye.
Farr, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
I believe that was 18 ayes and zero nays, so the motion prevails, and House File 3345, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Farr. With that, we've concluded our agenda, and the meeting is adjourned.